Vishnu Padaya, Krishna Prasthaya, Vrindavan, Srimate Bhakti Vedanta Swami Nityananda. Namaste, Saraswati Devi, Gauravaya, Charanam, Yavasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasasas
Shrirupam Sadhujatam Sadhunayanaganatam 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 Sadhvaitam Sadhurupam Parijinam Sadhunayanaganatam Sadhunayanaganatam Shri Radha Krishna Padam Sadhunayanaganatam Shri Krishna Padam.
So yesterday we talked about humility and we were looking at what personality? Indra. So today we're going to look at it from Krishna's side. I'm going to look at forgiveness. Is that right? Mm-hmm. And water would be really nice. It's pretty astonishing, actually. I mean, if somebody tried to kill you, all your family members, and flood the village, and just, can you imagine that? Somebody comes here and wants to flood New Varshana. And you couldn't tell the difference between the hills and the valleys. And all the cows are running away, and the rain is falling like sharp piercing arrows. And you're shivering with the cold. And then you just forgive the person. It's okay. Just don't do it again. And who would do that? So this is one of the most beautiful qualities of the Brahmana, is forgiveness. And we're going to look particularly at Prahlad Maharaj, who exemplifies both. Thank you, sir. Exemplifies both the attitude of forgiveness and the intelligence of a good ruler who knows when to externally excuse and when to externally punish. Start with reading this verse. This is from 7th Canto, chapter 10. I'm not sure if you have this on there or not. No, you don't. So you don't have this one, I'll just read it. 7:10:15:17. Prahlad Maharaj said, O Supreme Lord, because you are so merciful to the fallen souls, I ask you, it's not there. I ask you, it's not there. It's not there. It's not there. I ask you for only one benediction. I know that my father, at the time of his death, had already been purified by your glance upon him. But because of his ignorance of your beautiful power and supremacy, he was unnecessarily angry at you, falsely thinking that you were the killer of his brother. Thus he directly blasphemed your lordship, the spiritual master of all living beings, and committed heavily sinful activities directed against me, your devotee. I wish that he be excused for these sinful activities. So this particular verse exemplifies what forgiveness is and what forgiveness is not. So let's look at the story now of Maharaj Rikit and Shamaka Rishi. It's interesting because this very, very similar story is one we'll be meditating on this week in the Gajendra Lila. Very, very similar between Gajendra and Agastya Muni. So Shamaka Rishi was in trance. He didn't know that Maharaj Rikit was there. Maharaj Rikit comes in thirsty. Have you ever been really thirsty? Like really, really, really thirsty? I'm thirsty. Have some water. Have some water. And Maharaj Rikit was the king. He was accustomed to commanding. Hey, who's water? You know, people were supposed to just, yes, sir. And Shamaka Rishi didn't even reply. So this person not respecting the king, so he takes a dead snake and puts the snake on his neck. And Prabhupada calls this tit for tat. You all know this expression? Tit for tat. Like the Bible says, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. And Prabhupada also says that this tit for tat is silly. I'd like to ask all of you, why do we want to do this when somebody offends us? First of all, if none of you have ever had anybody offend you and you've never offended anybody, you really never need to be here. Okay. I guess
guess you could just learn this to help other people. If we've ever had anybody do something where we felt wronged, where we felt, you know, an injustice has been done to me, this person has harmed me, or if we've ever harmed anybody, that's a lot less likely, right, that we've ever harmed anybody. All innocent and lambs, and we never harm anybody. Why, when somebody harms us, do we have this tendency to want to, thank you, to want to get back at them? No, one's water, one's ginger tea, it's not too much. Sometimes I get two waters. Sometimes I get four waters. I wonder if they think I'm Vermont or not. But this is different. So why do we do that? Any thoughts? Somebody hurts us, I'm like, I want to get them. I want vengeance. I want to get back. I want to see them suffer. Yeah.
Because it's natural, because the powerhouse of Krishna,
he sometimes does that. And he didn't do that with Indra. I mean, if you really want to think about who offended Krishna and Krishna's devotees, Indra's got to be way up there. Way up there. I mean, you think of the other demons that came, they mostly just went for Krishna. Indra went for everybody. You know, if someone comes on the property and just attacks you, well, that's the temple president, let me get him. You know, maybe you could excuse them or whatever, but they attacked the whole property. They flooded the temple. They flooded the farm. You know, all the devotees' houses were flooded. Everybody was spending that. You're not going to let that guy back on the property. So Krishna forgave him. That was pretty amazing. But yeah, Krishna does also, somebody comes at him. Kind of like that Pondraka. Pondraka came to Krishna and said, hey, Krishna, give me all your weapons. He says, sure, here's one. Okay, why else do we want to hurt people? But Krishna actually doesn't have a vengeful mood. Why else do we want to hurt people who hurt us? Yeah.
To defend ourselves?
Can you be a little bit more specific? What do you mean by that?
To stop them from hurting us.
Okay, to stop them from hurting us further. And I'm convinced that that's one of the main reasons that we want those who hurt us to suffer. Because it's self-preservation. Now, by hurting them, either I'll actually, like, stop them. I'll put up a wall so that they can't hurt me. Or how else will hurting them prevent them from hurting me, I hope. I mean, I may not want to hurt them directly. I may want someone else to hurt them. I may want them to fall and break their leg or something without my interference. Krishna, please let them fall and break their leg. But why do I think that them having some equal or greater amount of pain will protect me?
They'll learn a lesson and think twice before.
Yeah, I want them to learn something. But I want them to learn for whose benefit? For my benefit. So I'm hoping that if they learn, then they won't hurt me again. You know, like you have an electric fence to the animals, and they learn if I touch the fence, I get a shock. So I want somebody to learn, hey, you mess with me, you're going to get in trouble, you know, don't do that. Or I might want them to learn in the sense I want them to know how much it hurts. I might be trying to protect myself by hoping I'm going to engender empathy in the person. Because I'm assuming that when people hurt me, they don't understand how much I've actually been hurt. If they could only understand how much pain and agony they caused me, they surely wouldn't do it again. Now, particularly, I'm going to have that mood with people that are close to me, rather than people I mentally call enemies. People I mentally call enemies, I just may want some kind of a wall. That people will think, hey, don't mess with that person, it's going to hurt. But with people who I care about and I want to have an ongoing relationship with, I may want to engender empathy. Hey, this is what it feels like. Please don't do that to me. Why else might I want to hurt somebody who hurts me? Yeah?
To reassure self that we have power.
Okay. That's another kind of self-defense. That I've got power, that I'm not just vulnerable. That I can't just be stepped on. Any other ideas? Pride within myself. I think some of the things, thinking that it shows that I've been right in whatever the conflict was. If the other person gets smashed, then I must have been in the right. I must have been the wronged party, and they must have been the wronging party. By the way, is that always true? That when somebody offends me, that I'm right and they're wrong? Is that always true? Have you ever had one of those situations where you were sure that someone offended you and you found out that actually you had offended them? That's kind of what happened with Indra and Krishna. Right? That's what we were reading yesterday, where Indra comes and said, I thought you offended me. Came to Krishna and said, I thought you offended me. And now I realize I'm the one who's offending you. All right, so we're trying to just physically defend ourselves, putting up some sort of a wall, a personal banging your head on the wall in the tree. Or we're trying to defend ourselves through empathy, that the person will learn something, they'll understand, oh, when I do this, it hurts somebody that I care about, I don't want to do that anymore. Or just, I can hurt you, I can protect myself. Or just see, I'm right. See how much you've suffered? The law of karma is in my favor. Honestly, I am the innocent party. I am the victim. All right, what's wrong with this? Why does Prabhupada say it's silly? And why does Dharma the Bull say that when you act like this, you become as guilty as the person who hurt you? I mean, it seems to be a natural instinct. Somebody hurts me, I hurt them back. That's what animals do, right? And animal-like humans, that's how they punch me, I punch you back. Just simple. But what's wrong with this? What's the harm? Okay, it's taking the law of karma into your own hands. There are some people who are allowed to take the law of karma into their own hands. In fact, they're supposed to. They're supposed to be agents of the law of karma, and we'll get to that a little later. So what else is wrong? So if you're not an agent of the law of karma, then what's wrong with acting as an agent of the law of karma when you're not?
Well, often you don't understand all the factors that are involved.
And that was, in fact, what happened with Maharaj Burkitt. He didn't understand that Shamukha Rishi was in trance. And again, we'll be looking at that this week with Gajendra. Same thing happened. Augustine, when he comes, doesn't realize that Indrajumna is in trance and curses him. Of course, same thing happened with Daksha Maharshi. Didn't take the time to find out the whole story. Just assumes, hey, I can understand it. So, but one reason not to do it is, you know, I might be making a mistake. Maybe things are not what they appear. And maybe I'm the one getting bad karma by trying to hurt the other person. I haven't yet found out the whole story. So there's a true story in this regard of a man who went to a restaurant and the waitress brought him the wrong order and spilled the juice on his lap and kept forgetting things. And he thought, well, I'm not going to leave any tip. You call it a tip here? I'm not going to leave any tip for this waitress. And his friend who was at the table said, hey, you know what happened to this woman? He said, no. He said, well, 5 days ago her husband died and she's left with 6 children. So that's a big tip. So sometimes we don't know the whole story. You know, we think that somebody is disrespecting us or offending us or hurting us, and we don't really know what's going on. We don't really know what they're thinking. And we'll look at this again more later on this week, but one way we can be reminded of this is when it's reversed. When someone thinks I've insulted them and I've offended them, and they never bother to find out the whole story. I don't know if I have time, but maybe I should tell you a personal story in this regard. There, in our Gurukula many, many years ago, we had a family from South America, and 2 of the children had just come from South America. They knew hardly any English. But their mother and father had been there for some time. One of those visa things where they let the parents in but not the children. He actually helps the children into the country. I don't know if I should say this in recording. So the mother was our cook for the school. She would cook lunch every day for the school. And one day, right before lunch, I got a very upsetting phone call from one parent. They were yelling at me about something, and I was really upset. And I said to the other teacher, in front of the children, they were serving out prasadam, I said, I'm too upset to eat anything. I said, make me a plate. I'll eat later. I want to stop at the temple gift shop and get something. Can you be in charge of the children? She said, sure. So that night, the father of those two children called me up and said, I'm taking my children out of the school. And hung up the phone. And I kept asking, what did I do? What did I do? People said, well, you insulted their mother. And nobody would give me a straight answer. I'd say, what did I do? You were just mean. You insulted the mother in front of the children. What did I do? What did I do? Nobody would tell me what happened. And it became a whole thing in the community. And finally, I went to our GBC like 2 months later when he was visiting. And I said, Reverend Surfubu, what did I do? And he said, I don't know, something about you insulting the mother's cooking in front of her children and saying you didn't want to eat anything, you'd rather get something from a shop than eat her cooking. And I said, I didn't say anything like that. I said, what is he talking about? I'd completely forgotten what I said. Then I woke up in the middle of the night to Superstore, and the whole day of the play, I thought, oh my God, they didn't know English very well. And when I said I was too upset to eat and I wanted to get something from the temple shop, they thought I was insulting them. But they never asked me. You know, the father never came to me and said, what did you say? 2 months. Finally, I stopped the man at the door of the temple room for greeting the deities. I wouldn't let him go out after greeting the deities. I said, Prabhu, I want you to come in front of the deities. I'm going to talk about it in front of the deities. I'm going to tell you what happened. And then we became good friends. Not later on. But has something like that happened to you where somebody thought you said something or you did something and you didn't really do it, or they just misunderstood you? I mean, in this case, this man went around the whole community criticizing me. Has that ever happened to you? And you're trying to explain, that's not what I said. That's not what I did. That's not what I meant. So how do we feel when that happens to us? So we should maybe take the time to think that, hey, maybe I can make the same kind of mistake. I'm so sure that this person did this thing, this person said this thing, but maybe it didn't really happen. Maybe it wasn't what happened. You know, Daksha never stopped and thought, maybe Shiva isn't disrespecting me. Maybe he's in meditation. Maybe that's not what happened. So that's one good reason not to immediately say, okay, let me hurt the other person. What's another reason? By the way, if I go to hurt somebody and they're innocent, that's pretty bad karma for me. It's one of the seven deadly sins, right? To bear false witness, to say somebody did something when they didn't. So the person who's really going to suffer is me. What's another reason why I shouldn't want to hurt those who hurt me? Yeah. That's actually my conclusion about what Dharma the Bull means when he says that those who name the perpetrator are just as guilty as the perpetrator. If you say, that person hurt me, you're as guilty as the person who hurt you. And for years I was like, what? Huh? But if you have this mentality of blame, this is the person, this is an evil person who hurt me, you get in this angry mentality of wanting to do harm for others. And isn't that what you're blaming the other person for? You're saying, hey, you wanted to hurt me. Well, I want to hurt you. What's the difference? I was just reading the other day, I can't remember if it was in Chaitanya Charitamrita or Srimad Bhagavatam, where Prabhupada was saying that this keeps the cycle of karma going. You know, I want to hurt you, you want to hurt me, I want to hurt you, you want to hurt me, I want to hurt you, you want to hurt me. And guess what we do then, life after life? We come back and hurt each other. Sometimes as husband and wife. Sometimes as parent and child. Chitra Keti talked about this with his child. He said, maybe his child is an enemy who's taken birth in my family and died after a short time to give me pain. And that happens. I really want to hurt this person. Let me become their child and be crippled and die at the age of 2 and break their heart. I'll get them. Meanwhile, you've got to be a crippled kid who dies at the age of 2. Or, you know, let me become this guy's wife. And I'll just, you know, make his life miserable. But then you're in a miserable marriage, too. You know, you think about that. And then it keeps going on and on and on, you know, when you're in this marriage with your enemy from your previous life. I know some devotees were, you know, they were always fighting. Some astrologer said, you guys died hand-in-hand combat on the battlefield. And they were still doing it in this life. And then you can do it again next life. And maybe you reverse roles. You know, then one's the husband, the other one's the wife, or whatever. You know, or one becomes the mother-in-law. They're still at it. This actually happened with Amba. You all know the story of Amba? So she was one of three sisters that Bhishma kidnapped to marry Vijayachariya. And the other two sisters, Balika and Ambika, they said, okay, you know, we'll marry Vijayachariya. And Amba said, I'm not marrying Vijayachariya, I'm in love with Shalva. How dare you kidnap me? You know, well, okay, we'll send you back to Shalva. And Shalva says, I'm not touching you. You're supposed to be Vijayachariya's wife. Bhishma kidnapped you, you're his problem. He goes to Bhishma, Bhishma, marry me. Who would want to marry somebody who hated you? You know, you ruined my life, marry me. And he said, sorry, I have this vow as a brahmachari. No way. So she did all these austerities. She went to his guru, Parasram. You ever do that, complaining to someone's authority? So she went to his guru, Parasram, and she said, hey, make him marry me. He said, Bhishma, marry her. That's your kshatriya dharma. He said, sorry. Took a vow as a brahmachari. He said, also, it really wouldn't be a very happy marriage. And he had to fight with Parashuram. He defeated Parashuram. And did Amba accept it? Did she say, okay, it's my karma? No, she performed austerities. Really intense austerities. Took another birth, performed austerities, and that second birth took another birth. And then finally was able to be the instrument for the death of Bhishma as Shikhandi. So just see, she had association with one of the Mahajanas, with Bhishma. She's living at the time of Krishna. And all she does is take birth after birth out of vengeance. So that's another reason why it's not good to perpetrate this cycle, you hurt me, I'm going to hurt you, because you can stay here and play that game. Krishna's going to let you stay here and play that game for a long time. Okay, another reason why we don't want to do this. Definitely acting as an ego instead of as a servant. Although we will look at how a person can mete out punishment as a servant. And that is possible. Okay. So basically it's going to damage me. Do you think this goes on in Goloka Vrindavan? Do they have like some vengeance system and court system and law of karma? And by the way, this whole concept of justice, does that exist in the spiritual world? Is there a concept of justice? No. It's here. And I would give a little caveat. Be really careful about becoming too attached to justice, to this concept of justice and fairness. Be really careful. I know one devotee asked a question to Bhaktivedanta Swami once. Why isn't Krishna fair? You know, if Krishna was really fair, none of us would ever go back to God. That's the bottom line. Can any of us say that after joining the Hare Krishna movement, we've never done anything to hurt anybody? I mean, do we really want to suffer for every little thing we've done wrong? We'd never get out of it. Now, how many hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of lifetimes of reactions do we already have? And Krishna's going to excuse them for saying the Sinarama. You know, that's not fair. So, when we talk about fairness, we usually talk about it for the other guy, not for ourselves. We don't generally want to play fair. We want the other guy to play fair. So there is a place for justice. I keep saying, we'll look at that later. Because any of you are like, what about justice? What about justice? What about kings? We'll get there. Promise. All right. So it brings out this attitude of us, of hatred and envy. It brings out a desire to take birth again. It also just inculcates in us the general materialistic mentality of karma and reaction instead of mercy and love. An interesting thing is that when we accuse others, by the way, and some of you are going to say this is nonsense, but I found it to be true, that when we accuse others, the faults we find in others are generally faults that we have. We're very sensitive to faults in others that we have. Now, I didn't used to believe this. I used to believe, you know, yes, Indragoba Madhavendra Mahaswakarma Bandani Upapala Bhajana Latinoti Karmadhinadhikinpincha Bhakti Bhajan. And I thought, well, I'm doing Bhakti Bhajan, so Karmadhinadhikinpincha, I don't have any karma. And so whatever's coming back to me, I'm just innocent. I don't do anything. I used to actually believe that. You know, the law of karma applies to all of you. And certainly everybody out there, but me? No. I never do anything wrong. And I'm a devotee anyway, so. You know, I don't have to worry about sitting on the strength of chanting either. I'm a devotee, so every Krishna's just going to kind of brush everything under the rug that I do. And I don't remember exactly what point, but at some point, I woke up and said, oh, maybe the Shastra's talking about me too. Maybe it's not just everybody else. And what I started doing is when people hurt me, I started asking Krishna, please show me how I'm doing this to somebody else. And every single time, I saw that I was. And not necessarily back to the same person, and not in the same way. So they might be, you know, inconsiderate in a way that I never inconsiderate, but I'm inconsiderate in a different way, with different people. And once I started seeing that, I was astonished at how whatever I get back, I'm giving out. And I think especially when we're chanting Hare Krishna, that's applicable right now. Krishna isn't really punishing us for things we did 200 lifetimes ago, but it's things we're doing right now. So this is evident in the story of Durvasa Muni. I'm going to read a few verses from the ninth canto. You remember Durvasa Muni cursed Maharaj on the leaf. You all know that story? Well, just briefly. Durvasa Muni shows up as Amrish Maharaj is supposed to break his fast. And he says, Amrish says, can I give you something to eat? He says, I want to take a bath first. And while he's bathing, the break fast time is ending. You know, we have this break fast window. It's part of the rut. Part of the breath is stopping at a certain time. And I'm just like, I've got to break my fast, or my whole year's vow is not going to be proper. So he thought, well, I can't eat before my guest is eating, but I've got to break my fast. What am I going to do? And I'll drink a little water. That's eating and not eating. And Durvasa comes back, you drink water. Because he was a yogi, he could tell. You drink water. And he tried to kill him. Durvasa Muni tried to kill King Amrish for drinking water while Durvasa was taking a bath. Kill him. Not just yell at him. Kill him. Okay? That was Durvasa's mentality. Now, just see what he accuses Amrish of. Still hungry, Durvasa Muni, his body trembling, his face curved, and his eyebrows crooked and frowned, angrily spoke as follows to King Amrish, who stood before him with folded hands. Alas, to see the behavior of this cruel man. Who's the cruel man? He is not a devotee of Lord Vishnu. Who wasn't acting as a devotee of Lord Vishnu? Being proud of his material opulence in his position. Who was proud of his material opulence in his position? He considers himself God. Who is considering himself God? Just see how he has transgressed the laws of religion. He was talking about himself. Amrish was faultless. So often when we criticize others, we're actually, the fault is in ourselves. All right. Just let's look at external and internal. External forgiveness, and you have this on your sheet. If you look at the bottom of your first sheet where it says Mahabharata. Remember we talked about Prahlad Maharaj. So this is a conversation between Bali and Prahlad. He says, which is actually meritorious, forgiveness or the use of strength? And Prahlad says, neither forgiveness nor the use of prowess is meritorious in all situations. If one were to always forgive, then his servants, dependents, enemies, and even strangers would disrespect him. When one always forgives, then mean-minded servants gradually steal all of his wealth and fail to respond to his commands. On the other hand, one who simply punishes and never forgives soon finds himself to be bereft of all friends. Indeed, everyone comes to hate such an unforgiving person, and when there's the slightest opportunity, they do something to harm him. Therefore, the conclusion is the prowess of forgiveness to be exhibited at the proper times. By devolving, the following person should be forgiven: one who has done nice service in the past, even if guilty of a grave fault; one who offends simply due to ignorance or folly; one who is a first-time offender; one who has committed some wrong against his will; and in addition, other offenders may sometimes be forgiven just to create a good public image. The following person should not be forgiven: one who has knowingly offended and yet claims to be innocent, even if his offense is slight, and a second offender, no matter how small, will come. So what Prahlad Maharaj is speaking about here to Bali is acting as the agent of karma. Prahlad Maharaj, in this particular instance, is the king. He's speaking about how to be a king, how to be a leader, how to be a manager, how to be a parent, how to be a temple commander, a head pujari, a temple president, a mayor, a governor, a president, when your duty is to be one of the agents of karma. If you don't correct your children, if you always excuse your children, then they're going to get punished by Durga Devi later on because they'll become criminals. Even Mother Yasoda was worried about that. That's why she chased Krishna with a stick. She didn't want him to grow up to be a criminal. Seriously. And the other gopis would complain like that too. They'd say, you know, Mother Yasoda, if you keep letting Krishna do all these naughty activities, he's going to grow up to be a criminal. No, it's the duty. You have to. Prabhupada told the story of the man who was being executed and bit off his aunt's ear because she never trained him. So if you never put your child in the corner, if you never take away their cookies, if you never correct them, you know, then later on they'll be punished by Durga Devi. So you're meant to give a slight correction so that they won't have to suffer later. The same principle, the government is supposed to execute criminals so they won't have to suffer later in their next life. So when we are in a position that we are the agent of Krishna, of Yamaraj, and sometimes we are, I mean, we have to be honest, sometimes that's our duty, then we follow this external behavior. This is talking about external love, your behavior. Do you give someone a consequence for their behavior, or do you say, oh no, it's excuse, you don't have any consequence? I mean, Krishna didn't give Indra any consequence, except some humiliation that he couldn't flood Vrindavan. He didn't take away his position. He didn't demote him at all. What to speak of not killing him. I mean, he deserved to be killed, didn't he? Attempted murder of 200,000 people and cows, but he didn't. So that's externally excusing someone when you're in a position of authority, or you may externally punish somebody. So that's one meaning of the word forgiveness. That if I am in a position of authority where my duty is to mete out punishment or decide who's going to be punished, that I may sometimes choose not to give any punishment to a guilty party. I may excuse them of their crime. I may say, you have no punishment you have to suffer. Or a lighter punishment, like the judge who says, okay, do community service. You know, go plant flowers at the Hare Krishna temple instead of going to jail. So that's one meaning of forgiveness. And if we're in a position where we are supposed to act as an agent of Yamaraj, then we have to take that into account. It's not that being forgiving means that everybody who's our subordinate should always be externally excused. But let's look at the other meaning of forgiveness, and that's going back to the verse I read at the beginning of this class. I'm going to read this again. Prahlad was talking about his father. He said he was unnecessarily angry at you. Thus he directly blasphemed your lordship, the spiritual master of all living beings, and committed heavenly sinful activities directed against me, your devotee. I wish that he'd be excused for these sinful activities. So the mood here of forgiveness is existent even when the king punishes the wrongdoer. That the Rajarishi always has this mood. The Rajarishi doesn't have a vengeful, angry mood. I want to get those criminals. And we notice that Prahlad Maharaj two things here. He admits that Hiranyakashipu has done something wrong, heavily sinful activities directed against me. Prahlad Maharaj said, he offended you more than he offended me. So one thing forgiveness is not is forgiveness is not foolishness. Forgiveness is not, no, you didn't do anything wrong. No, you stole $40,000 from me, and you went around telling lies about me in the community, and but you didn't do anything wrong. That's not forgiveness. It's not foolish. You don't become a naive sentimentalist. It's not condoning. It's not looking at the wrong deed and saying nothing bad happened. It's not that. It's admitting something bad happened. And you did it. Maybe something really bad. Now, I wish that he'd be excused. Prahlad Maharaj wanted his father to be liberated. Did he want his father to go on committing sinful activity? No. We were talking about how one reason we want to hurt others is to stop them from doing it again. So he wanted his father to stop doing it. For whose benefit? His father's. Was he worried about defending himself? No. Why wasn't he worried about defending himself? He already felt secure. Why did he feel secure? Depending on Krishna. Okay, so there's several things here. I'm depending on Krishna. Who's my protector? Krishna. Mare Krishna, Rake K, Rake Krishna, Mare K. Krishna wants to save me, no one can kill me. And if Krishna wants to kill me, no one can save me either. It's not any of us think we're going to live forever in this body. We're all going to die. It's not because I'm chanting Hare Krishna. I mean, do you want to live forever in this body? I never could figure out why Hare Kashyapu wanted to live forever in that body. Who wants to live forever in this body? Especially once it gets really old. So, you know, someday Krishna's going to kill this body. And then nobody will be able to save us. So if Krishna wants something so-called materially bad to happen to me, nobody can protect me. And if Krishna doesn't, nobody can hurt me. And that's one of the six symptoms of surrender. Krishna's my protector. Krishna's my protector. I don't need to protect myself. That's part of my service as a devotee. I put on a seatbelt and I look both ways. That's part of my duty to Krishna. But if I think that by wearing a seatbelt I've become my own protector, I'm a fool. You know, I may have a duty as an administrator to punish a wrongdoer, but if I think I'm doing this for my own protection, Ishwara I'm protecting myself, my partner, then I'm a fool. Ahankara vimuha. Krishna's protecting me. Even if I have a duty of punishing wrongdoers, I'm doing that as a service, not to protect myself. So first mentality, Krishna's taking care of me. And then I want this person to become rectified for whose benefit? For whose benefit? Their benefit. So what am I feeling towards them? Compassion. And maybe even love and affection. That's quite different from feeling anger and envy, isn't it? I'm going to get you. I hope you suffer. Good thing is about karma. You know, one is like, I'm getting into this evil mode myself. So in both cases, I want Mr. Nasty Evildoer to be fixed. In both cases, I admit that this person did something wrong. I'm not tiptoeing around it. Mr. X did something wrong. And I want Mr. X fixed. But one is, I want Mr. X fixed because I'm a doer, and I'm my protector, and I'm going to protect myself, and I hate Mr. X, and I'm going to have a party when he suffers. Woohoo! Bring out the samosas. And the other is, Krishna's protecting me. Krishna's protecting me. I don't have to worry about anything. If Krishna wants Mr. X to hurt me, well, it's going to hurt me. You know, let's go and I'll just hurt him out, folks. Right? Did they do that? Is it a snake? Is it a statue? Is it a cave? Is it a demon? That doesn't matter. Looks like fun to us. Maybe it's a demon, Krishna. I remember what he did with Baka. Let's go in. I remember in Detroit, there were some local kids coming and stealing from the temple. And Prabhupada said, it's not a sin to be stolen from, it's only a sin to steal. So don't prohibit them. He said, don't leave your valuables out, but don't prohibit them. Give them some prasad. So Krishna is going to protect me, and I want you to be fixed for your sake. Also, I'm confident that whatever's happening to me is good for me, and I deserve it. I deserve it not in the sense of, I deserve it, I'm so good. Not like that. But it's good for me. It's beneficial for me. It's the prescription from a loving doctor. And it just so happens that this Mr. X happens to be the agent in my prescription. You know, or it's what I ordered. I must have put out this in some way. I must have placed the internet order, and this is just the... You have FedEx? This is just the FedEx. This Mr. X is just the FedEx guy delivering my order. I ordered the wrong thing. I was nasty and inconsiderate. I spread a false rumor. I criticized somebody. And Mr. X just happens to be delivering my reaction. Why should I be angry at Mr. X? I should feel sorry for him that due to his contamination of the modes of nature, that Krishna used him as an instrument in that way. Or if it's not my karma, it's a lesson from Krishna, the master teacher. Krishna wants to change me and fix me and develop me as a devotee, and he feels that this circumstance will be good for me, just like a teacher tells the child, stop playing, sit down in the desk and do your math. And the child may say, well, I don't know where to play. And that's not a punishment for some bad karma the child did, but it's part of their lessons for development. So the devotee sees like that. Krishna's protecting me. What's coming to me is either a lesson for my spiritual development that's not related to karma, or it's some karmic thing that I need to develop empathy. This Mr. X or Miss X or whatever, or Mr. and Mrs. X, they just a FedEx person. Why should I be angry with them? The ultimate cause of my happiness and distress is me and my material consciousness. But it's so sad that Mr. X or Mrs. X has allowed themselves to develop this hateful mentality. And I hope that they get rectified in this mentality for their sake. All right, now we're at the last. We got the stages so far. Krishna's going to protect me. Krishna's my protector. What I'm getting is either karma or a lesson. So I'm not going to hate the instrument of my karma. Prabhupada told that to Peter Brewer. She said, never hate the instrument of your karma. Krishna's protecting me. What I'm getting back is good for me. It's beneficial for me. It's being given to me lovingly. And I want the perpetrator to be rectified for whose sake? For their sake. All right, now the last thing is, this is the end now. Those of you who are hungry and counting minutes. So who here has learned a valuable and important and wonderful lesson by going through some suffering and difficulty? Who's learned something, a lesson, but you had to go through some suffering and difficulty to learn that lesson? Okay. Who's here learned a wonderful, valuable and important lesson through a very blissful experience, through a happy experience? Who's learned a valuable lesson through a happy experience? Some of you have never learned anything in your life, I see. Okay. We'll have to talk to you later. So, what would you prefer? Would you prefer learning your lessons through pain and suffering, or would you prefer learning your lessons through joy? What would you like? Joy. I mean, it's a simple, joyful thing. You open up one of Prabhupada's books, and you read a purport, and one of the sentences jumps out at you, and you go, wow! That's amazing! That's a joyful way to learn a lesson. Okay, now we're going to look at another. I don't know if you have this one. Yes, this is on your paper, toward the bottom. This is from Bhagavatam 4.8.17. Don't wish for anything inauspicious for others. Anyone who inflicts pain upon others suffers himself from that pain. This was spoken, anyone know? Who spoke this to whom? Anyone know the context of this verse? Yes, Dhruva Maharaj. Who spoke it to Dhruva? Suniti. So Dhruva came with a mood of vengeance, and Suniti says, don't even desire that somebody else suffer. Don't even desire. I've personally seen devotees go through terrible suffering because they just desire suffering for someone else. I just saw one instance where one devotee A went to the temple president and said, that devotee B, they're this, they're this, this, this should happen to them, that should happen to them, this should happen to them, that should happen to them. And all those things happened to devotee A 3 years later. Right now. So guess what? There's a way to get all, or at least most, of our lessons joyfully. Would you like that? Would anybody like to sign up for that? So that whatever I need to learn, I'm going to learn it through joy, maybe through ecstasy. I won't have to learn through suffering anymore. Well, one part of it is when Krishna tries to teach you joyfully, respond to it. Don't wait till he has to hit you over the head. But the other way is don't desire your so-called enemy to learn through suffering. If we desire those who hurt us to learn through suffering, guess what? That's how we're going to have to learn. It ricochets back to us. So how should we desire those who hurt us to learn their lessons? Through joy. Now you can develop it. It's a real simple mantra for this. So the first, when I first studied this, by the way, I had several years. This seminar was several years under development in my own life. And I can say that the way that I got started on this seminar was by reading a book. We had a big Gurukul library, about 4,000 books. I think you have more than that in your library. I was so proud of my 4,000 book library. And one of the parents who helped out a lot at the school, Guru Bhakta, she lent me a book, or gave me a book, for the library, and I always read the books first to make sure that they were good. It was a book about a man in the former Soviet Union whose job was to beat up religious people who were praying. That was his job. They called them believers. Of course, they were mostly Christians, but he might have beat up some devotees too. And if anybody had a gathering where they were praying, you know, if you just prayed by yourself in your house, they'd leave you alone. But three or four people gathering together to pray or read a Bible. They would go, they'd have metal clubs covered with rubber, and they would beat these guys. They weren't supposed to kill them. Their instructions were don't kill them, but make them unrecognizable. And they would try to break all the bones in their face. And then the people would never get any medical care, of course. They were just put in prison. So that was his job. And he had two things that happened. One was a very young, beautiful girl at these meetings who they would beat her, and she wouldn't stop going to the meetings. When they let her out of jail, she'd go again. And at one point, they said to her, why do you do this? And she gave this guy a Bible, so he started reading the Bible secretly, because he was supposed to burn it. But what happened is he was reading the Bible, he actually got more and more and more and more and more angry, because he realized how sinful he was. Quite an interesting thing. So he hated the religious people more and more and more and more and more. He went to one meeting, and there was, remember, you weren't supposed to kill anybody. So there was one 56-year-old woman who was praying in the corner, and he took his stick to go hit her, and she looked at him and she said, may the Lord forgive you. And then he got really angry and he thought, who are you? Think that you can kill you. And he picked up his thing higher to get more force. And as he did that, somebody grabbed his hand from behind. Couldn't do anything. And he thought, oh, there's another believer back there. I'll get them first. Turned around, there was nobody there. And he got so scared. He dropped his club and he left. Anyway, he ended up becoming a religious person himself. He joined the Soviet Navy, jumped off a ship near Canada, swam to Canada. wrote his book in Canada, was eventually killed by the KGB. But what particularly struck me about this story, I thought, who's this Christian lady? Maybe she's even a mediator. And she was ready to forgive somebody who was going to kill her for praying. And the force of her forgiveness was so great that some higher entity protected her. And I thought, well, here I am, a Hare Krishna devotee, thinking I'm so much better than this Christian. And I'm thinking forgiveness is for something later after I become a human devotee. That's for the Prahlad Maharajas and the Haridas Thakurs. It's not for the other. I'm going to be morally vengeful and nasty and angry until someday she becomes pure by some magical something. And when I read that, I felt so ashamed. And I thought, oh, this Christian lady can do it. What's wrong with me? So that was the beginning of my journey. And then I thought, you know, why don't I forgive? And what is forgiveness? And how do you do it? And after doing a lot of research in the Shastra, then I decided to try to practice this. And I will assure all of you, you will all get plenty of opportunities to practice this. You know what that means? Practicing forgiveness means that there are going to be a lot of people who do things that are worth forgiving. So I guarantee you, you will have an opportunity to practice it. So I had an opportunity not too long later after I was putting this together. One devotee was yelling at me about something. And I just stood there, and before I reacted, I thought, Krishna's protecting me. My protection is in Krishna's hands. Whatever happens to me is something good for me. It's either a reaction to what I've done, or it's a blessing from Krishna. Please, Krishna, rectify this person for his sake through joy, and not through suffering. Don't let this person suffer for what they're doing for me. Please rectify this person, but through joy. And it was a very mechanical thing when I said that first. I didn't quite have a cheat sheet, but almost, you know. It's like, what am I supposed to do now? Okay, what's the next step? What do I do? I don't remember. I mean, one person's yelling and screaming, and he's like, next step, okay, next step. But as soon as I did that, I felt peace. Not only did I feel peace, but I felt as if I was in a protective bubble. And that really, that the person didn't have any power to cause me any distress. So I found this to be very powerful. Also, what I've also found is that my lessons from suffering, it's not totally gone, but it's greatly decreased since I practice this. That most of the time Krishna teaches these things, it's now joyful. I don't have as many, you know, fire ordeals anymore. And I'm convinced the only ones I have left are because I don't listen when Krishna goes, after all, he just has to get my attention with a good fire. But I've really found this changed my life significantly. And I've taught this many times. I taught this once in a town called Split in Croatia. Imagine that. Let's split. Let's go to Split. And there was one person who was very new to Krishna consciousness, and he kept insisting that he had the right for vengeance against someone who wronged him. After we went through this whole thing, then you could see, oh, that's not really a very good idea. So I've included some quotes you can read on your own. I've also included, and some of you might criticize me for this, I'm sorry about that. I've also included here a Christian story, about a person who engaged in forgiveness, both internally, had a mood of forgiveness, and also engaged in forgiveness behavior. So we should again emphasize that a mood of forgiveness does not always mean that there's no consequence externally. If you're in a position of authority, you may sometimes have to give out a consequence to those who you're training. But the mood is always one of forgiveness. The mood is always one of compassion. The mood is never one of vengeance. Because even if you have the duty to punish wrongdoers, if you do that duty in a mood of vengeance, there's sinful reactions to that. That you're not allowed to do. And then you're going to the mode of ignorance. So you can read this story later on your own time, something for you to take with you for your own meditation. So we've gone about 12 minutes past 8:30. You could take maybe 5, 7 minutes, 10 minutes max. Yes?
Just an interesting point, you said that Spurgeon was an objective.
I know it's a little perspective, but still, Krista does on there. And we got here somehow.
Well, there you go. I'm defeated.
I'm sure you have that. Just carrying my mind, because we're all here. So someone's.
But as soon as you come into justice, you're here, you're not there. There's no police force. You know, there's some mood of morality and ethics. You know, Krishna creates this sort of illusion of morality that he's not supposed to meet with Radharani. So there's some idea like that. But there's not really a justice system, and there's no karma.
So
how
do we were in the spiritual world.
We're not exactly here out of justice. We're here because we wanted to be here. Well, the system is that there's kalpa vriksha trees and this chintamani dust and Krishna's eko bhavinam yogadati kaman. So if you really want something and you insist on it and you're going to throw a temper tantrum about it, you know, there's one conversation with Prabhupada says that Krishna really tries to dissuade the living entity. But if you really insist, okay.
The Prabhupada says 3 times.
Yeah, it's... We really insisted. No, it's desire. We're not here as a punishment. It's not that God is like, you're not going to love me? Suffer. We're here because we want to be. And you know, when one first enters the material world, Prabhupada says one enters as Lord Brahma, there's practically no suffering as Lord Brahma. Basically, it's a mood of, I want to serve Krishna and be God too. I want to serve Krishna as a God, rather than just as a servant. So, okay. Have a universe. Be God of the universe. And you can be a devotee too, but you're not your spiritual body. You're not even eternal rasa. You know, in the spiritual world, only God is God. You say, well, you know, okay, I want to be a devotee, but I want to be God too. I want to be both. Get to be Lord Brahma. You're kind of both. And, you know, some Lord Brahmas probably say, whoops. And others say, hey, it's not so bad. I think of it like, you know, you're told, don't drink alcohol. It'll rot your brain. So you might think, well, let me try it. You drink one beer, and, you know, you drink one beer, your brain hasn't fallen out of your head. The consequence seems very minor. And you might think, well, that's not so bad. Why did everybody tell me it was so bad? And it's a very gradual, step-by-step thing before you're drunk in the street. It's not that you're some wealthy man's son going to Oxford and you drink one beer and then you're a bum in the gutter. So it's not that, you know, we're in the spiritual world and then I got a human calling you the body. You know, it's not like that. One nice example is that of Daksha. So Daksha is born as a direct son of Lord Brahma. He's one of the Prajapatis. He's practically on the equal level of Brahma. And then he offends Shiva. And he sort of kind of apologizes. But he only apologizes to get free of his reactions. He doesn't apologize from the heart. So he has to take birth again. And this time he has to take birth. He wasn't, first time he's a direct son of Lord Brahma. You know, no being in the womb and being born. And so next life he has to take birth, and next life he takes birth from Satyus. The Prabhupada explains this in the purport, that that was his reaction for offending Lord Shiva. He had to take birth from a woman's womb, he had to take birth from Satyus. Of course, there were pure devoted Satyus. There were the changes, I mean, pretty good deal. Then in that life he offends Nara. And he was still so elevated in that life that he saw Lord Vishnu face to face and experienced some bhava. Says in Bhagavatam, when he was chanting the Hamsagriya prayers, he experienced some bhava when he saw Lord Vishnu. But he offends Narada, and then we don't hear about him anymore. Then he disappears from the pages of the Bhagavatam. You know, Narada tried to help him out, preach to him. Narada even let Daksha yell at him to get rid of his anger. So then he would be open to preaching, and he wasn't. So I see our fall down to something like that. You know, very, very gradual. We see this even generally for devotees who stop practicing Krishna consciousness in this life. We don't throw very many people out of ISKCON. I mean, that's unusual. I think Prabhupada only threw out two people. And it was the same point. I mean, he said, go and enjoy. Usually people leave because they want to leave, because then it's usually a very gradual thing. You know, they start watching television instead of chanting their rounds one day. They just chant 14 rounds and they watch the TV show. And they don't feel that different. That wasn't a big deal. You know, or they go buy a sandwich from an outside shop and they still remember Krishna. It's not that big of a deal. Then they do a little more and a little more. And if all you're looking at is the step right above you, it doesn't look like much of a fall now. Very, very casual. And it's only sometime if you look all the way back up and say, oh, wow, I was all the way up there. What happened to me? But no, it's desire. The Prabhupada says in the first canto that one can go back to Godhead simply by desiring to do so. And Krishna explains in Bhagavad Gita 12.9 that the whole purpose of sadhana bhakti is to develop a desire. That's the price, Rupa Goswami says, is the desire. It's all, that's all. Everything we're doing is just to develop and cultivate the desire. And we are here because of desire. And that's, we didn't talk about this yesterday with humility, but by the way, that's the essence of humility, is saying, I'm here because I want to be here. I am completely 100% responsible. I am not being punished. I am not being excluded. It's not Krishna's fault. He's really nice. This was a real one-way problem here in this relationship, and I am completely, totally, 100% responsible because I am completely, totally, 100% a fool. So I don't see that as justice. I see that as Krishna is like this really soft. I mean, if we have any complaint against him, is that he should be a little harsher with us, maybe. He's this really soft, indulgent father. Eko bahinam yobiradati kaman. I mean, he says, don't do this. Look, it's a really bad idea. Like he tells Arjuna, don't do it. He said, if, however, you act in false ego, not hearing me, you will be lost. And then he says, now I've explained everything. Do what you want to do. But please, always say to me, and please say to me, please. So do whatever you like. So Krishna's very, very soft. I mean, he says, hey, you know, look, you do that, you're going to hit your head against the wall, and it's going to hurt. It's going to hurt. That's a wall. It's not a door. There's a door. There's a wall. Don't walk into the wall. I want to walk into the wall. It looks like fun. Look at this. And we walk in the wall. Why did you make the wall so it would hurt me? Huh? You know, if I say, well, I really want to eat this cup, some guy got in the Guinness Book of World Records for eating an airplane. Bit by bit. I don't know what that did to his digestive system. But if I said, you know, I don't want to drink the ginger tea, I want to eat the cup, I'm going to break my teeth. Is that the fault of the cup manufacturer? Is that some sort of just system of justice? Cup eaters will be punished by having their teeth broken. That's not what's going on at all. But I'm doing something that's unnatural. I'm doing something that's against the way my body is constructed. So I am Jivara Swarupaya Krishnarini Chidasha. That's my construction. That's who I am. That's my identity. If I do something that's opposed to my identity, it hurts. Now, I can talk about that as karma and reaction, as sin and punishment. I can say, you know, the cup maker designed the cup to punish people who try to eat it. And there's some... Okay. So that's the material perspective is like that. The material perspective is Krishna has set up these laws of nature to punish sinful people. And from a materially conditioned perspective, that is a true statement. From a liberated perspective, that's not a true statement. From a liberated perspective, the true statement is, if you do something against your nature, it'll hurt because it's false. If I think a wall is a door, that's false. Therefore, trying to walk through the wall hurts because it's not true. So if I do activities that are false, they hurt because they're not true. That's the perspective of the liberated souls. But for people who are absorbed in passionate ignorance and justice and then you have to say things like, God is punishing you, this is sin, this is piety, if you do this, you'll get money, if you do this, you'll get poor. So I see it like that. As far as the cursing, I don't know. If that's one of those, Ekayani wrote some letters to Prabhupada about Goloka, and Prabhupada wrote back, he said, better you go there yourself, or you can figure it, see, ask yourself. So I think we'll have to ask Radharani personally why she did that. I don't know. I'm not going to pretend to be able to answer that question. Was that all right?
Yeah. Gives more thought to the mind and the intelligence, like, you know, remember that.
Oh, good. You go ahead and rip it apart. We'll go at it tomorrow with that. Actually, what's really nice about saying that I'm here because of my desire, on the one hand, it means that I'm very, very foolish. I'm foolish beyond foolish. I've got to be the most... That's why the great devotees say, I'm the most sinful person. You think, what are they talking about? They didn't commit rape and murder and burning villages and... But just that I was foolish enough to come here means that I'm just, there's just no greater fool than me. And on the positive side, if I'm completely responsible, guess what? I can do something about it. I'm not helpless. Somebody else will be running out of time. Yes? Ask what?
Is it wrong to ask to be wary?
Be wary? No, that's just smart. So if there's people who have a tendency to hurt others, it's probably a good idea to cross the street when they're walking. That's just intelligent. But without fear? Because Krishna's protecting me. Mari Krishna Rakhi Ke, Rakhi Krishna Mari. Without fear and without anger and envy. With some respect. Prabhupada said you don't go embracing tigers. So I think we all know people who, I don't know, they seem to just lash out at other people. It's unfortunate, but I think we've all met people like that. That I remember one GBC man said to me about another devotee, so-and-so is a walking offense. So, you know, we've met people like that. Who can I criticize? It's like, you know, it's what they eat for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. It's how they get their jollies. Have we met people like that? Maybe we've been somebody like that at some point. Maybe we are somebody like that, I don't know. But, I mean, we all know people like that.
Ah, look what they've done wrong. They tied their shoe the wrong way. Let me write it up on the board.
You know, the Ramachandra Puri types. So, yeah, you can avoid them. Sometimes you can't avoid them. Sometimes you have to work in the same office or live in the same house with them. And then that's some lesson from Krishna. You can't, but, you know, if you can cross the street, yeah, cross the street. Actually, I was just thinking when Mahaprabhu was young, that's what the Vaishnavas used to do with him. He would argue logic with the Vaishnavas. And they would actually cross the street. So they wouldn't be defeated by Mahaprabhu. That's what the Mayavadis did with Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati. Also, he was known as Singha Guru, the Lion Guru, so they avoided him. But yeah, the Majjhima devotee is supposed to avoid humans. The Majjhima devotee is supposed to be discriminating and say, this is a person that I can make friends with, this is a person I can help, and this is a person I should avoid. Not good. That's smart. Forgiveness doesn't mean you walk blindfolded in front of cars. Anything else? Yes?
This discussion this morning seems to relate a lot to this popular concept of the law of attraction. That if we have a blind mentality, then Krishna will provide a lot of opportunities for us to see what we have. You know, if we've got a mood of blame, Krishna will arrange for us to be able to fulfill that
Yes.
Nature.
Yes.
So it seems that forgiveness is the mood of the honeybee looking for the positive side and therefore attracting more of that.
Yes.
And then the blaming side is more like the fly, which is focusing on the negative side and attracting more of that.
Definitely. We really do create our own fortune and our own life. We really do. It's the essence of it is treat others the way you want to be treated, because that is how you'll be treated. that's the reality. And if I don't like the way I'm being treated right now, then instead of fixing all those other people who are mistreating me, the person I can be fixing is myself. What am I putting out? And if I don't like what I'm getting back, let me fix what I'm putting out. And it may take a while for the fan to slow down. It's very powerful, and it really works. It's true. Our philosophy is not just simply something that's intellectually satisfying that we can use to say how much better a philosophy we have than anybody else. It's actually true, and it works, and you can feel it and experience it in your own life. So thank you very, very much. Tomorrow we're going to be doing a multimedia presentation on Lord Amila, Krishna willing. And then this week we're going to be looking at the Gajendra pastime. Some of the same themes, as I said, have come up in this Gajendra Lila with Agastya Muni cursing Indrajumna for being in trance, and how Indrajumna as Gajendra and as Indrajumna responds to this person. Thank you. All glories to Srila Prabhupada.